Hey everybody, this is Dave Broadbeck coming to you from what I pretentiously call my podcasting studio. The course you're about to hear, the lecture you're about to hear, is from a class called Psychology and also Biology, 2606 Brain and Behavior. This is one I do every year, and it's one I really love. So I hope you enjoy the lecture, and have a good time.
Okay, so, so there's another pathway, as I mentioned. I think this is, we left off in the slide. That's the superior colliculus and the tectum, and the pulvinar and the pulvinar and the thalamus. This is an older, probably an older one. It's a tectopulvinar system. That there's medial pulvinar that goes to the parietal lobe, and the lateral pulvinar ends up sending stuff to the temporal. Now there are two different then streams of information that are processed. The temporal stream, the ventral stream goes to the temporal lobe. There's a picture of that. I changed the pictures this morning because I realized how shitty they were, and I keep, every year I go, I got to change those pictures. So I changed them today. The dorsal stream goes to the parietal lobe. That was discovered, discovered is probably not quite the right word, but figured out. Because let's give him credit. Let's give Mel Goodell credit. Discovered by Mel Goodell of Western, University of Western Ontario. He's won a series of awards for his pioneering work in behavioral neuroscience, cognitive neuroscience. The notion here is that you have sort of two different visual systems. One of them is doing vision for action, and one of them is doing action for vision. So, vision for action is like, what do I do? Action for vision is, where do I put my head? What do I focus on? Okay. Recently, people have talked about how, in fact, there are probably dorsal and ventral streams for audition, too, for hearing, which is quite cool. So, it may be the case, in fact, that other sensory systems that we have are set up like this. This diagram does a nice job of explaining all this stuff. So, there's basically three, remember this? There's a superior colliculus there. There's where is it, what is it, and how should I react? The ventral stream is what? Right? The dorsal stream is how. So the ventral is action for vision. What should I do? And the dorsal stream is the how part. Vision for action. How should I react? So which of these things do you think is the oldest of these three? Because we got where, how, and what. Evolutionarily, what do you think is the oldest and why? John?
Where?
Something? Yeah. Yeah, that's probably the oldest one, is the where stream. Okay. Think about this. You can't know how to react or what something is before knowing where it is. That's probably the oldest. And in fact, if you look in the sort of evolutionary record, you look at the various animals, you'll see, in fact, that the where stream is the one that is preserved, that is oldest. Okay. So about 90% of the connections from the optic nerve go to the geniculostriate system, and about 10% of them go to the colliculus. Shouldn't be. I screwed that up.
It should be tectum.
I was all proud of the nice diagram I made, and it's wrong. The below one there shouldn't go to LGN. It should go to the tectum. Damn. I worked for 5 minutes on that diagram, and it shows. So that should go superior colliculus, tectum V2, LGN V1. Tecto pulvinars down there, geniculus striates up top.
I almost feel like changing it right now. I'm not gonna, but I feel like it. Okay, so what's now we're into the occipital lobe, V1 to V5. We have two kinds of cells in V1. We have blobs and interblobs.
Oh, lose my connection here.
Yeah, we have blobs and interblobs. Let's try that again.
Man.
Yeah. Gonna do something here. Lost my connection. The whole world's falling apart here. Okay. Try again.
Oh, that's annoying as hell.
Okay, let's try using my phone. I wish this could be more annoying. So, and the way they're called this, because when V1 is stained, there are certain cells that look like just big blobs. So they called them blobs. And the funny thing is, then they discovered other cells, and they're in between the blobs, and what better thing to call something that's in between some blobs than interblobs? They could have used Greek or Latin. Thanks for using English. I appreciate that, even though the words blob and interblob aren't great. So what blobs do... That's a stupid saying. What blobs do is they figure out color. They respond to the color of something. Whereas interblobs do motion and form. That's what they're responding to. Information then goes on to V2. And you produce dorsal ventral streams. Now, I talked, I think, the other day, yeah, I did, about receptive fields, right? Remember I drew that horrible diagram? So, the image on the retina will cause a certain part, so a piece of light, a photon, a packet of light, hitting a part of the retina will cause a given cell to fire, right? And that cell has a receptive field. Just kind of like the same way that a cell for touch has a receptive field on your skin. Right? This is actually coded into layers on V1. But it's not a one-to-one relationship. You've lost some fidelity, I guess, my way to put it. But the top layer of V1 is the top part of the image. This is to the point, in fact, where in an MRI, you have to really read this from a subject with a bunch of stimuli, but then from an MRI, you can actually read what a person is seeing. Paper in 2009, I think I mentioned this, in the journal Neuron, that actually people presented with a word and the computer was able to figure out what they were seeing, what the word was. The word was neuron, which is great. That was, I believe, 100 by 100 pixels. It's now up to about 1,000 by 1,000 is the resolution people can do, which is still nothing like what we see, but it's even nothing like I see. Pretty poor vision. But it's getting to the point where you're going to be able to read the one and detect what people see. Because everybody's vision is hooked up when it gets to occipital lobe the same way. There'll be subtle differences, but for the most part, it's hooked up the same way. So these cortical cells also have receptive fields. So they map onto the receptive fields on the retina, but they're bigger than the receptive fields on the retina. So many ganglion cells from your eye then map onto a cortical cell. Does that make sense? Do you understand that? So let's say, and I'm just taking a number, that 10 cells that are close to each other, 10 ganglion cells that are close to each other, all map onto a single cortical cell. So when that cortical cell fires, your nervous system knows, and I'm using that in a shorthand, it doesn't really know anything. So your nervous system knows then that the light must have been somewhere around where those 10 cells were, or are, I'm sorry, on your retina. Does that follow? You're okay with that? Okay. Now, between different cells, there are what's called adjacent cells have colossal connections. That just means that the columns of cells are connected. It doesn't mean it's huge. Right? Oh, that is colossal! That's not what that means. So, if we were to draw like a... I will draw something here. On the board. Oh, now my iPad wants to work. Okay, good. Like using my phone, it's harder to read it. All right, so if I was to... Like this for a second.
Yeah.
So, yes. Why would you put the chalk where on the little tray? Why not leave it up here? So here's your V1. Okay. This is. We'll just pretend that this the blackboard here is V1. So we've got these cells. Connected, so we'll do four. Let's do four. Okay, so the only connections, these colossal connections, are going to be going like this. Here to here, 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 here. You don't get, and then of course there, same as here. There is no connection that goes like this. Nope. So it's not going from column one to column four. Or column 1 to column 3, or column 2 to column 4. It's column 1 to 2, 2 to 3, and 3 to 4. There's more than 4 columns than that. Okay, does that follow? Yeah, please, Sean.
Would the connections also, for example, like 1 to 1 down?
Yes. Yes, there's also down, but those, I'm going to talk about adjacent columns, not adjacent rows. Yep, definitely. Yes, so there are connections, of course, going this way. Ooh, God, it's got this room with the heat and the hotness and the hot heat. Where's it cooler in here?
Where's the weather in here?
Somewhere, it's a warm day in here. Okay. All right, other questions? I'm going to come back to this in a second because there's a lot of ways this works. Because I think I'm almost certain you'll be able to figure out how we detect motion. So we have the and all those cells, again, have a receptive field on the retina. So let's say, again, and I'm just picking a number, and it's not 10, but let's just, for the hell of it, say 10. So 10 cells in a certain area of your retina correspond to 10 cells in a certain area on layer 1 of V1. Okay? That's cool, right? Makes sense. And it's a... So if I can detect which cells are firing, I can then go backwards and see what was on your retina. Right? And if I can do that, your nervous system can do it. So if I'm looking at I being the all-knowing consciousness, I hate the word consciousness. I hate it because I can't define it. And I can't prove it exists. So it bugs me. Anyway, if I look at the contrast between the luminance, the brightness, the amount of firing between different adjacent visual fields, and I can do that because they're connected, and I can see if one's firing and the other one isn't firing, then I can see edges, can't I? Right? Remember we talked about how to recognize a red triangle? We talked about how to need an edge detector? Well, an edge detector of some sort would see, is this cell firing and this one not firing? Contrast in luminance. Okay. We have what are called simple cells. It's good, it's English. It's not Latin. They do line orientation or edge orientation. So is it straight up and down? Is it sideways, 45 degrees, whatever? Complex cells, the orientation and movement. How are they detecting movement? Somebody guess, other than Sean, because Sean's good at guessing and he's guessed a lot today. Somebody else. How are these complex cells detecting both orientation and movement? We know they're detecting orientation, that's easy. We already figured that out. How are they detecting movement? How would you detect movement? If you were looking at this thing, at these cells, are they firing, are they on, are they off? How would you say, oh, there must be movement? No, Sean, yes.
As they fire in like a succession.
Yes, exactly. Oh, they must. Something must be moving because it was on, now it's off. Right?
Adam.
Points for Adam. There will be prizes at the end of the term. You want Sean to win all the damn prizes? Start answering questions. Okay. There will be no prizes. Oops. Then we have hypercomplex cells. You can probably guess the order these things were detected in.
it's more complex than complex. What do we call it? Really complex? Super awesome complex? No, let's go with hyper.
Inhibition on one side. In other words, which one's being turned off and which one's being turned on? The inhibition is off, right? What's that doing? What do you think that one's doing? What do those cells do? It's a little harder. It's a little counterintuitive, actually. It's not hard. Anyone other than Sean? This one is counterintuitive. So if you can't get that one, going once. Close! Oh, I thought you had it. See how I started to run and get all excited? It's so close. What's your name again? I can't remember. What is it again?
Ryan.
Ryan. I remember your last name. All goes together. Ryan's close. Half a point for Ryan. Sean's got two. So one. Somebody, any other ideas? It's very close. You're very close. This is counterintuitive. What you were saying there was intuitive. Actually, it makes more sense. This is a sort of a weird thing. Okay, see if you can tie Sean.
Would it just be
No, don't get caught up in visual fields. You might lose a point for that. No, you know what it is? It's actually detecting what direction the movement's in. One said the complex cells detect movement, the hypercomplex cells say which way is it going. So which side is being turned off says it must be moving to the left and right. Yeah, I know that's weird, isn't it? There's cells that detect movement, and then cells detect which way the movement's going. It's all happening in V1. It's pretty cool, right? All right. So V1 and V2 are basically like clearinghouses or routers. They send information on to V3, 4, and 5 and other cortical regions, which go up to the ventral and dorsal streams. Different bits of information are deposited and then routed. There's post offices or routers. I like router, probably better. So we see connections from blobs in V1 to V4, so we know V4 must do color. All those cells, the simple, the complex, the hypercomplex, are interblobs, right? Because they're doing form and they're doing movement. They are not doing color. V4 does some stuff about form. It's kind of like shapes of colors. Oh, you mean like red triangles? There's a reason I chose that example. I mean, I could have used red circle, but...
What's the fun in that?
Yeah, whereas triangles are the most fun of all the shapes. Especially the isosceles, or the scalene triangle. What's that rule? That's all the triangle. Right. That'd be more. Don't really care. Obtuse angle. Acute angle. I loved that stuff when I was like grade 10. Like the side angle, side theorem. All that crap. I couldn't do it to save my life right now. Held a gun to my head. I go, I don't know, they look the same, those angles. Wrong! Blow my head off. What a horrible... It's taking a dark turn. I had strange math teachers, all I'm saying. So V5 does motion and nothing else. We know this stuff not just because of connections, but because of lesions that people have had accidents to. V3 does dynamic form. This one's the weirdest one. This is objects in motion, shape in motion. So that's where the, is the triangle moving cell moving? Wow. That's going to be blobs there. Or sorry, that's going to be complex and hypercomplex cells, right? Okay. Questions so far? It's neat, isn't it? And it's amazing that we actually understand this pretty well. It was also a remake of V in a couple years ago. It was even worse. Okay, so if you get damage to V4, you only see shades of gray. Because you can't see color. If you get damage to V5, you won't detect motion. A couple of cases I'll talk about in a second. So V5 gets damaged, you don't see motion. Objects appear when they stop moving. You can't play catch. Can't do a lot of things. V1 damage, you get what's called blind sight. And a lot of Goodale's work when he was developing this sort of idea of the sort of two kinds of visual system comes from this. V1 damage, so you get blind sight. So you get things like, and I think I've talked about blind sight, where you can't consciously, there's that word again, you don't have the experience of seeing, yet you can see, because I can throw one of the things that's often done, it's first of all, is reach out for the object, and people put their hands in the right place and in the right shape. So if it's like to reach out for my little digital recorder here, might go in the wrong way, put their hand right there in the right shape. or you throw a Nerf ball at them, and they can put their hand up and catch it. They have no experience of seeing. But they see. And their eyes can track objects. But they don't detect that they're tracking.
When my father had his brain tumor, which was...
Now we're talking in 2008. And I was visiting him in the hospital. And he was telling me he was having trouble recognizing people's faces, which made some sense. But also, he was saying in the right part of his visual field, he couldn't see anymore. It was gone. Because the tumor was the size of a pool ball. So it's pushing back, okay? And it's pushing on his, so it's damaging his occipital. So I said, okay, you can't see. I said, but I want you to track my finger. And he could. And my brother-in-law looked at me and said, how the hell are you, what are you, magic? I said, no, the way this works. I said, there's got to be something good that can come of this. So now I have a story to tell a class. My father died for science. So V1 is where the brain is making sense of visual input or sending the information off that gets sense made of it. But the information gets there, but if you have damage to V1, it can't be sent further. Okay? So case studies can tell us a lot. I think these are all in the book. Okay, DB, which is not me, I had V1 damage and was blind, had blind sight. DB had an angioma, which is and it was removed, but the damage was done to V1. But DB reported having a feeling of what an object looked like. Couldn't say why. Pretty sure DB's a he. I remember. But I know there's an object here. I have a feeling there's an object here. And I have a feeling it's the following object. But I'm not seeing it now. JL, I believe that was carbon monoxide poisoning. It says in my notes here, so I'm sure it's probably what I wrote that. It's probably true. JL was an artist. And carbon monoxide poisoning damaged JL's V4 to the point where JL could no longer detect color. The world was now in black and white. And of course, it's not that you just can't see color, you can no longer even imagine color. So, especially when you're a painter, that must be a pretty nasty thing to happen because your life's work is painting and working with color and now it's gone. JL got very depressed, actually, because even the whole world just seemed lifeless. So people looked like rats. And that, because they all have the same sort of color, like there's no nuance to anything, right? And food became disgusting because it all looked the same gross shade of gray. It was all different shades of gray, though.
So that's pretty horrible, right?
You'd be amazed at how important color is in the perception of taste, by the way. Classic experiment, you give people, you know, the ultimate comfort food in sort of Western society, Western cultures is mashed potatoes, right? Okay? I make these mashed potatoes, they're basically just potatoes and butter, like an emulsion of potatoes and butter. About a half pound of butter, 4 potatoes. You eat it like twice a year, like, you eat like 2 tablespoons full of it. Well, that's enough for me. They make the greatest potato croquettes the next day. Anyway, so you take that, which tastes amazing, and people have their eyes closed, they taste it, it's like delicious, and then you blindfold. Then you take the blindfold off. One group has the regular mashed potatoes. They eat them as if it's gray. The other group, they've been dyed blue. The blue coloring. And people suddenly find them disgusting. And they go, oh, they don't taste good anymore. Amazing stuff. A buddy of mine does work on the color of plates. And how a plate color, if it contrasts a lot with the color of the food is reported to taste better. And it's the same damn food. It's really cool stuff. Even the shape. I don't know, there's a whole science behind this thing. Chefs, I think, know intuitively. Eventually, by the way, after about a year, JL sort of returns to art, changes up the kind of work I think it's a he is doing, but also the depression in it, so that's good. So it's a happy-ish story. LM is a fascinating case because LM, 43-year-old woman, has a stroke. And can no longer detect movement. Can detect objects, just not when they're moving. This is obviously a debilitating thing. V4 damage with JL is nasty, it's unpleasant, but JL can live an independent life. LM needs a guide dog. Because if you get to the street corner and there's no cars, that means either there's no cars or there's lots of moving cars. Because when the cars are moving, you can't see them. LM reported a teacup being filled and how disturbing it was to look in your teacup and there's nothing in it, and then suddenly it just goes swims with all kinds of tea in. LM actually learns a trick that a lot of people who have very low vision learn, which is when you're filling up a cup or a glass, you put your thumb in it. Which is something I do if I'm pouring myself coffee, I just put my finger in it. Just so I don't put too much in. I don't do it for everybody else. Everybody else just gets a little bit less than they probably want. But they also don't get my thumb germs. So it's a trade-off. And it also said, you know, going to a party was or any kind of gathering was very difficult because people would just pop into existence. Like, you'd be over here, so let's pretend you're LM. I'm standing here, you notice me, and I say, oh, Dave's there. And then I start moving, oh, Dave's gone. And then I stop, whoa, there's Dave! Wow, imagine that. That's got to be bad, right? Learning to live with that must be unreal. Okay, DF had sort of occipital damage, just very bad. I think was this a bump on the head? I think it was. It had visual agnosia. Could not detect, could not report what objects were used for, but could report what objects, sorry, could say what objects were used for, but couldn't say what they were. This is one of those ideas of those two visual systems. So you could do this in one of the common sort of quick and dirty neurological tests after someone's had a bump on the head is to pull, and the, you know, because the doctor will often have their car keys or their house keys in their pocket, and they'll say, what are these? And the description goes like, and you know, we would all answer keys. But the answer given is, it's an object that's used to open doors and locks. Right, what's that? Well, you know, it's for, so these are keys, an object that's used for that, yes. Another one often is a pen, what's this? And I remember, in fact, the after my dad's, he had an operation, he removed the tumor, and it was all kinds of crazy stuff there. But I said, Dad, what's this? And he said, it's for writing. I said, yeah, I know, but what is it? It's a thing. You write with it. What is that? Is it a pen, Dad? Yeah, a pen. So what's this? It's a thing for writing. Wow, right? Isn't that amazing? Whereas if you said, you took had some paper, and you said, what do you use this for? A person that had this kind of damage would say, you could write on it with a pen. What is it? It's a surface that one writes with a pen on. So is it paper? Yeah, that's what it is. So what is it again? Oh, it's a thing you write on. Amazing, right? D and T are two interesting cases because, and I can't remember which is which. One of these cases had parietal damage as well as occipital and couldn't recognize faces, and the other one couldn't recognize objects. showing that face recognition is something special. And there's a special face recognition system in humans and in other animals, other primates for sure. Questions so far? Concluding things about the visual system, it's pretty complicated. Some might say hyper-complex. But it's easy to understand how, and we did this sort of through first principles today, as long as you know the principles of these cells and how they're hooked up, you can figure out how the visual system analyzes input. And that's neat. The complicated part is how it's set up. And by the way, I was asked last week why... What's the evolutionary advantage to having your visual system in your occipital lobe? And all my colleagues around the world who I contacted said, can't think of one. So it was a good question, I believe. Go to graduate school, figure it out, write a paper, win a Nobel Prize. You don't win Nobel Prizes in graduate school, but you know, then get a job, and then you get Canada Research Chair, and then eventually Nobel Prize, just saying. And when you win, just mention my name. I don't really care if it's even positive. Just say, that bastard Broadbeck is horrible, and I hate him, and he didn't inspire me to this, and I hate him. Just even that would be enough for me. I'll probably be dead when you win the Nobel Prize, though, because some sort of North Korea thing. But probably I'll be dead. I'm so scared. Really not, actually. It's really counterintuitive how this works. I think it is, anyway. The idea that we detect motion and the direction of the motion by a separate set of connections is weird. To me. Maybe it makes complete sense to you. The idea that we do motion and color and shape separately but kind of all at once is also weird. The fact that it's seamless is amazing. We only know that it is different subsystems when we get these lesions, right? And it's not all occipital. There's the face stuff we just talked about. And the fact that you're going with these two different streams. Much of our brain is dedicated to vision. It's almost all, I mean, it's clearly important to us. It may be our most important sense in some respect, at least in evolutionary sense, because most of our brain is, if you want to look at how much is devoted to different sensory systems, more of it's vision than anything. We have a whole lobe of our brain that does nothing. Nothing but visual analysis. Any questions? There may be some asymmetries. We haven't talked about that. So left versus right is what I'm talking about here. I'm not sure, and the data on that are not entirely clear. That's why it says may. All right. So that means, in fact, we can go to talk about thinking. Thinking! I don't know why I would put an exclamation point. Yay! Okay. Oh, some thoughts on thinking. We are the most cognitively complex animals on this planet. I don't think there's any argument about that. That's not species, isn't man. We're more complicated cognitively than any other animal. No other animal sits around doing this. I wonder how thinking works. I think, right? Our closest relative, chimps, what do? They throw shit at each other. I mean, really, seriously. So I don't think that that's them having an existential thing going, I wonder how thinking works. Maybe I'll toss some crap at that other chimp and see what happens. It's not running a set of clever experiments. It's not a research program throwing poop at people. Science sometimes feels like that. We can think about objects that aren't present. We know this. It's probably the case that some other animals can do this. But we know we can think about objects that are not present. We can think about objects that don't exist, right? Watch this. Imagine if the sky was purple. Done. Or green. Done. It's easy. We can think about abstract ideas. Now, other animals can count. There is no doubt that other animals count. It's certainly the case that other animals, I would argue it's the case that other animals can add.
I've seen experimental evidence of such things, so I can tell you that other animals add.
Keep track of time. That's abstract in a sense.
But
what about abstract ideas like calculus? Like derivatives, right? Other animals, their nervous systems do it all the time, but they aren't aware of it, they can't discover it. There's something special about people. And it's, who knows where it's from? We talked about this at the very beginning when my eye wasn't opening and I had to have it all dark in here, my ball cap down like that. So you may not remember this. You may just remember my professor's weird and his eye isn't open. But if you remember this, that like us standing up probably had a huge effect. It's probably that. It's probably also us eating meat. Really, seriously, if you're, be a vegetarian all you want, but eating big hunks of meat fat probably really helped us. And bone marrow.
Bone marrow.
Fire, so we can cook food. All these things probably helped us develop this huge brain. So we'll think about abstract ideas. How about justice and freedom? Equality. Because those are things, again, I don't think animals enjoy being caged, but I think it's more of a, I want to run around, not, this violates my rights as a chimp. I don't think they're thinking that, right? I think. Seems unlikely to me, is what I'm saying. We use symbolic and syntactic language. That is something nothing else can do. There is no experimental evidence that anything else uses, that isn't at least under question, that other animals use symbolic and syntactic language. They communicate, sure, but that's a different matter. Sign language stuff with apes, no one's entirely, no, I shouldn't say no one. The animal cognition community is certainly not convinced that that is language. It's impressive stuff. Nobody's arguing. We can plan and string events together. We know we do this. Again, other animals have some ability to do this, but not in the level that we do. We can plan for very long periods of time, is what I'm saying, unlike a lot of other animals. Okay? So there's something special about us. One wonders then how's that encoded in the brain? How are thoughts encoded in the brain? This experiment's mentioned in the book. So remember V5, monkeys have V1 to V5 too, so that's great. Okay, so a monkey is hooked up to, as a EEG on it, okay? It sits and watches a screen. That's the task. Actually, no, it's not an EEG, these are a single cell recording. And watching a screen, and there are, the monkey's task is to detect when there is more motion to the left than the right, or the right than the left. That's all it has to do. As soon as it detects that there is more motion one way than the other, it pushes a button and it gets a squirt of orange juice in its mouth. Opens its mouth and it gets a squirt of orange juice. Pretty common reinforcer for monkeys. They like orange juice. The other one, actually, oddly enough, and I kid you not, is Purina Monkey Chow, and I'm not making that up. They actually make monkey chow for labs, right? Or banana pellets. These pellets that just are basically pulverized banana and hardened, and monkeys, again, they really like those. This is a good guess. Stereotyping monkeys. They like bananas.
They do.
Okay, so that's a pretty neat task, actually. So you're recording from V5, and what happens is, because we're recording, we can tell when the decision is made that we have more movement one way than the other, right? But then we can tell when it drives behavior. I'll just say that. And there's a really cool thing that happens. There's a lag.
I don't want to use the word lag.
But I will. There's a lag between a time difference, let's go with that, between when the monkey's nervous system detects there's motion and when the monkey pushes the button. It's 300 milliseconds. It's a positive spike in the cell firing, and it's 300 milliseconds. It's P300. That's 3/10 of a second. That's quite a long junction. Happens in us too. Now, we don't do it with us. We can't do it with. We don't use single cells, and we wouldn't have to have monkeys anymore either. You just use an EEG. And if I had you, for example, looking at a clock, okay, and I said to you, every time it hits 12, and it's sweeping around every like 2 seconds, every time the hit the button, you're pretty good at that. You're dead on accurate, except for. The firing that happens in your motor system happens 300 milliseconds before you actually hit the button. In other words, 3/10 of a second before the clock hands hit 12. Your brain says, fire. Yeah, your brain knows stuff before you're conscious, before you're aware. Of a second, too. Think about this. When you catch a baseball, or whatever your preferred sport is, I don't like sports. I don't care. When you catch a ball, and I'll use baseball, I'll use basketball, I don't care what. The decision to put your glove out, your hand out with the glove on, to catch the ball, happens 300 milliseconds, this is amazing when you think about this, before you actually put your hand in. When a batter playing baseball goes to swing, the decision of when and where to swing happens 300 milliseconds before the pitch actually goes across home plate. And think about that. With somebody who's throwing a real fastball, somebody who's some real heat like Nolan Ryan used to, unreal. He's throw the ball at 103 miles an hour. He's pitched 7 perfect games in his career. What a ball player. He once broke a catcher's hand because the catcher thought it was called for a curveball and he didn't throw a curveball. Fastball. The decision has to happen as the pitch leaves his hand. Wow. Holy. That's pretty neat. All these words I'm saying right now, the choices to say them are happening about 300 milliseconds plus or minus something before they actually come out of my mouth. Assuming I'm actually thinking. So individual cortical neurons in this case are in the monkey case, are making decisions that you are not consciously aware of. We know it's true with monkeys, it's also true with people. This is first done with monkeys, tried with humans. It's like, okay, that happens. That's a thing. So, first of all, thoughts are happening without us being aware they're thoughts, which is interesting. Probably well over 90% of the cognitive activity we have, we aren't aware of anyway, and it's completely inaccessible to consciousness. Hebb had this idea of what's called a cell assembly. And I know some of you guys have already read this stuff because, in fact, read about this because some of you used that in your answer with Arnold Hebb on the test, which is way to go. this is the idea that a pattern of cells firing represents a thought or a concept or an idea. So when I said the red triangle cell, it's probably more like, it's we think of all those things firing at the same time, we could call that a cell assembly. Okay? Make sense? So, yeah, good. I thought I had a spelling mistake there. What we call the association cortex is key in thought. It's where we're putting different stuff together. Anything that is not primary is called the association cortex. So in other words, we call it primary visual cortex, primary auditory cortex. Anything that isn't primary something, or then there's the motor and sensory. So a lot of your frontal lobe, a lot of your parietal, some of your temporal, is associating input and thoughts, sort of stored memories and concepts, things like semantic concepts. That's, and it's associating those things, so it's called association cortex sometimes. Okay? So the thalamus projects to all these areas, but it also, there are connections from primary cortices to association cortices or association cortex as well. And there's connections within association cortex, of course. So within, say, your frontal lobe. Wow. It's complicated. What you're doing is here, you're putting together the sensory world and your knowledge and various other things, and you're having experience. What do you want to call it? Okay. It's pretty neat. So this is sort of like consciousness. I got it in quotes there just because I don't like the word. And I don't like the word because I cannot define it. I can't measure it. So I don't like things I can't measure. But I will say there is consciousness. I just don't know what it is. So, but we have this ability to deal with spatial stimuli. Humans are great. So do other animals. All kinds of animals do. It may have something to do with our ability, our spatial awareness may have somehow been what evolution hijacked and turned into human consciousness. So, we evolved, our common ancestor with the chimp, who was a tree dweller, we're pretty sure. When you're a tree dweller, you should be pretty good at knowing where things are in relation to each other, and how far away they are. Pretty good at spatial things, because jumping from one tree to the other, you don't want to fall. The ones that fell, they didn't pass their genes on. Right, so we already had that, but now suddenly we're living on the ground. This isn't humans, by the way, this is like Australopithecus. This is just after we've split off, us and the chimps have split. But we're on the ground, walking around. So we don't need this incredible spatial sense anymore, any more than any other animal, but we have it. So knowing where you are, evolution can hijack that and turn it into knowing who you are. How would we test that hypothesis? Well, short of a time machine, might be difficult. But we can look at different primates and see if they pass the dot test. You know about the dot test? You anesthetize an animal, you paint a red dot on its forehead, okay, or some color, I'm just picking red, and then you show the animal itself in a mirror. After it's learned about, so you show itself in the mirror, and then you see what the animal does. A human past the age of 2 will go, "What the hell? A red dot." A chimp will go, "What the hell? A red dot. Call my ancestor, that's good." A gorilla will just look at it. Maybe display, because there's a mirror. But no idea that that's him or her. Okay, that's suggestive at least. I like it. I think it's a great story. I'm not entirely sure I'd buy it, but it's cool. I think, you know, also the sort of standing up and the big heart and all that stuff I was just talking about, it had something to do with our consciousness. We do have specialized subsystems that deal with different types of information. Some people call them modules, cognitive modules. Okay? So these modules are kind of, think of them this way, they're like thinking organs. Okay? They're like thinking organs. Yeah. So we have a module for space, perhaps. We have a module for time, for number. Yeah. Okay. And that module that's spatial, the question one can ask is it geometric? Is it just about geometric relationships among things, or is it something else? Okay. So here's a question that me and a couple colleagues asked a few years ago back when I was at a different university. So this is actually from a talk I gave. I will explain it more than I did during the talk. These are two of my honors thesis students, Andrea Pike and Corey Spracklin. There's Andrea and Corey. The interesting thing is Corey was reading a paper at that time. Right there when you zoom in, it's a purely geometric module in the RAT space representation by Ken Chang. So Chang in 1986, is an old paper, started talking about this, and it's actually a cocoa puff, not a ball, because he had rats searching for cocoa puffs. Because rats, of course, as we know, are cuckoo for cocoa puffs. So he found that rats would use the geometric information in a box as a box spell. What, a meter by about half a meter? Maybe a little more than half a meter. And it had sawdust on the floor, and he would bury a cocoa puff in one corner. And then the rat's task is to go back to that corner and eat the cocoa. Okay? Rats don't smell good enough to detect cocoa puffs, don't worry. So, here's how it's experimented. So, you can see here that there's this box. Now, it's got different cues on it, right? Like different shades and we have here, like different patterns. Even at one point, using smell. So he used peppermint oil in one corner, and the rats didn't follow the peppermint oil. They follow the shape of the box. How do we know it's the shape of the box? Look where they make mistakes. There's the right answer. Look where they make mistakes. Opposite corner. Not here, not reflections, but rotations. Does that make sense? So it's like the baited area here is what? Short left, long right. So when the rat's put back in the box, goes short left, long up, goes here. So the shape is telling the rat something. The rat is following the shape. So rats were then responding to the geometry of the box. Do you understand a chain experiment? Very cool. Okay. So let's try this with people. Hermer and Spelke did this. They tried the chain tasks with toddlers and adults. What they would do is they would disorient the subjects. They were brought into a white room completely, but it was rectangular. Okay? The adults were told, that's the corner. The kids were shown a teddy bear. Because they're 3.5-year-old kids, you can't just say it's over there. You say, and then they disorient the subjects. How do you disorient the adults? You put a blindfold on them and you spin them. Right round, baby, right round, like a record. How do you disorient a 3.5-year-old? You talk to them for 45 seconds. Seriously, what do you have for breakfast? Oh, it was great, we had cocoa puffs. And then, you know, then they, where was the thing? There! Because that's how toddlers talk. Things like that. Okay, I don't know what I was doing there. Whatever Rugrats thing I was doing there. So, but then they used a cue. Then they painted one wall blue. And as you can see here, we've got what? Is it on the... Here we go. Here's the adults. Oh, look. This is sort of... this is where they make their choices. You put the blue cue in, and nobody screws up. Very little. Toddlers, in fact, they still screw up with the blue wall. So toddlers are not unlike rats in this task. They are following the shape of the room. Adults are different. They seem to follow the cue. So it was assumed then that the cue itself is part of the spatial representation that adults have, and the spatial module learns about these features. Pike found this in 2001 when she had a piece of actually Bristol board on a spinner and had a white stripe and she would spin it. And while she was spinning this thing, people couldn't keep track of where the where she had pointed was the right corner because she had people count backwards by 17 from the number 10,000. And then she'd been distracted. Because you go, you know, 10,000, 9,983, 9, and then you're screwed, right? It's hard to do. So you have to do it out loud so you can't cheat. Yeah. All right. So what we did, I can't believe I had to try to use my phone to do this. I don't know why my computer's being so screwy today. Was. So what we did is we took, we rotated the object. We figured if we rotated the object fast enough, people couldn't detect. Couldn't keep their eyes on where the correct corner was. So subjects were shown a red dot on a black rectangle. The rectangle was spun about the middle. The dot faded away, and people were asked, where was the dot? Very straightforward. So that's what this setup looked like. I just put that in there for our software developer who did this, which thanks to him. So that's what they were showing. So this comes on the screen. Let's go back. There's the red dot. Where was the red dot? Right? This is 20 people, each doing 40 trials. 31% to the original location, 33% to the rotation. Hey, that looks like Chang's thing. Yeah, but there's no Q. Put a blue Q on there, and it becomes trivial. Apparently not. Aha, we spun it fast enough that people couldn't process, I guess, the blue stripe. Neat. So in fact, they aren't putting the feature on the representation they have of that object is actually that independent of detecting the geometry. People will use geometry in the task because they can't use the feature. It's too quick for them. Even though the feature's reliable. The only way we can do this is we can make geometry useless, and that's by using a square. Obviously, with a square, without it being cued at all, it's impossible. It's spinning so fast. It's spinning, if I'm not mistaken, 480 times a minute, 480 RPM. There's no way you're going to be able to. It was ridiculously fast. But if you cue it, suddenly now they do follow it. So what does this mean? That means there's a feature-independent geometric module in humans. Okay. In adult humans, this was done with university students, and people didn't think that. People thought that our geometric module processed features as well as geometry at the same time, and we've shown that that's not the case. So there's clear evidence here of feature-independent geometric module. So if we slowed the rotation, we could find better performance and fewer rotation layers. In fact, we rotated it. I say we. Corey Spratt, my lab at the time, he rotated it to the point where people started making errors. Because if it's too slow, people don't make mistakes. You've got to make it fast enough that people make mistakes. I'm not even going to go into that. Well, basically, think of it this way. And I have done some other stuff on this just a couple of years ago. When do people detect that a rectangle is a square?
Oh.
Because like if the ratio is like 1.1 to 1 of the sides, it looks like a square, but it's not a square, it's a rectangle. So the question then is, Is it always the same ratio? That's Weber's law, and in fact, yes. It's actually the case that each person's different, but each person has the same ratio they use of 1.1 or 1.2 or 1.05 or something to 1, no matter if it's a really small square or a really big one. Then there's Weber's law. Weber's law is the one, don't stand in front of a Shea Weber slap shot. That's a different thing. If we put the dot to the close to the center of the stimulus, I've played with this. Not much to say there. Using a touch screen might be fun. Doing this on something like an iPad or some sort of tablet and having people actually reach might actually change the results because, in fact, you have not only vision for action but action for vision. Might be neat to try this with some other animal, with, say, pigeons. Now, this was a talk I gave, and I always thank people when I give talks, and you can see that this was quite a while ago. This was in the mid-2000s when I did this stuff. You can see the guy on the left there. You recognize me? Wayne Keough. That's him in third year when he worked in my lab. A little chunkier back then, maybe. And then there's that's Perry, who's one of my students, with his rats. He's way too excited to have a rat. And there's Matt, who used to feed birds on weekends. And my kids were so young back then. And I always mentioned that that's snow. You have no idea what snow is. That's Corner Brook, Newfoundland. I will tell you, this sign was my front one. It said Trans-Canada Highway that way. It's 7.5 feet off the ground. So that's not screwing around. Now one could ask, hey, look, more experiments I did. This is really nothing. I'm just feeding my own ego at this point. Steph Tannenin is now a PhD in behavioral neuroscience and runs the... And the amazing thing is, this was only like 5 years ago that she did this work with me. And now she's got a PhD in running a laboratory in Toronto. Is it lateralized, the spatial process? The nice thing about this is I can skip some stuff because they're the same slides. Hey, look, it's still the same slides. I will say, however, when I gave this talk, the spin them right round, baby, right round got a big laugh from younger people, and older people got the in the white room with black curtains by the station reference, which is from Cream, a band that most of you people don't know who they are. So, yeah, that's me talking about that. Now, this is cool because doing it with chicks, Valerie Tagara, Valora, I was so happy that he wasn't at the conference. Because I butchered this guy's name. They covered one or the other of baby chicks. Now, we've talked about how chicks, how birds don't have a corpus callosum, so they can look at lateralization if you cover one eye or the other, and both eyes uncovered. It turned out that the spatial detection of spatial stimuli was lateralized. Okay? So we tried the same thing. We get similar results with humans if we have them looking either with their left visual field or right visual field with the old spinning rectangle thing. Human spatial tasks are generally lateralized. You do better on things that go into your right visual field than your left, so we figured it's probably true. So the spinning rectangle results, are they lateralized? So we did the same thing. White rectangle with a yellow, I think it was a yellow stripe. Still had a red dot. And it was done on a Mac, not a PC. But beyond that, it was basically the same thing. Dot fades. Question is, where's the dot? Feature, the yellow strip on the side or not. So it's the same task, except we're making people only detect it on the left side or the right. How did we do that? Put the rectangle very far in the left of the monitor, very far in the right, kept them staring straight ahead. Okay? So we figured they'd follow the feature more in the right visual field, so left field, right hemisphere, than in the other visual field. It just makes some sense to us. So an interaction of viewing condition by feature present or distance. home. Well, turns out, no. So, it turns out it wasn't lateralized. The pattern of errors was no different in the left or right visual field, which is a shame, because we really thought it would be. When I started my talk, when I gave this talk, I actually got up and said, spoiler alert, no. It's a shame. We also didn't get the same error pattern, and we figured that it's they weren't spun fast enough. What does this mean? So, in this task, we don't have lateralization. It says that much. We have a corpus callosum, and this spatial processing happens exceedingly quickly. So it may just be that. So we didn't find the pattern of errors. That's probably because of the speed of the right angle spinning. We used 90 RPMs, whereas we used before 480. We found some suggestive sex differences, by the way. Males made more rotational errors, but we only had 5 men versus 17 women, which is just because of the way the subjects we got, their sex was. All right. We're going to try it harder, try to make it harder. When does a square become a rectangle? I actually did that, which is great, a lot of fun. Is that lateralized? Last year, I did some stuff. When does a square become a circle? It detected brain... detected occipital lobe activation, but it's not ready yet to talk about. So I always thank my family and Montreal Canadiens just because they exist. And then I show some snow because, again, the talk was given in Florida. So the thing, what I'm saying here, after all this me talking about me and me, is that I'm pretty sure we have a spatial module. So it may be the case that input from this spatial module is cell assemblies, and it's cell assemblies on top of cell assemblies, on top of cell assemblies, if you want to use abstract. And that happens, then that's all figured out in the association cortex. I'm not saying that the spatial module, it needn't be in a particular place in the brain, right? It needn't be localized. So what I've done here, though, me and my students have done, is we have isolated this without any... doing any sort of wet neurophysiology. We haven't had to go into anything or anyone's brain. So we can do a clever behavioral experiment. Now, I think these are pretty clever experiments. I think, and we can do these experiments and look at this stuff and not care at all about electrodes and patch clamps. Right? So you can actually do this kind of stuff. So, is the dot is right there? Is that a thought? I think it's maybe. Let's go look at it. I'm going to finish this right now. Damn it. So, in the cortex, there are columns. And there are bunches of cells that go across layers of the cortex. I don't know what that even means, what I've got written there. But I can tell you that there are these columns of connections between layers, these columnar collections. Yeah, please.
Earlier you had mentioned you did it with like, chicks.
I didn't do it with chicks. That was Voltaire Gargano.
Well, do you know any
enough
quotes that
you
know he found that there was a lateral?
Oh, yeah, he did. He found it. That was what drove us. He said, well, yeah, what the hell? What is it? Yeah. So is this a thought, a column of cells? Is it, when they were first discovered, like, yeah, that's it, those are, I don't know. It's got something to do with the problem. But we put all of our sensory and memorial thoughts, all our memories and senses and experiences together, and we have this thing called an experience. We put all of it together and it's all seamless, isn't it? Holy, that's a really neat thing. This is sometimes called the binding problem or the hard problem of consciousness. How do we do this? That and the engram, the actual unit of thought or the unit of memory, if we can figure those out, they're like the neural grail. And when you win your Nobel Prize, because you figured out the binding problem. If you figure that out, the Nobel people will call you. That's a pretty amazing thing. And I think that's a pretty good place to end the course. We will have a review class. I will have a wrapping of the whole course up class on Wednesday. And then we can do some Q&A if there's going to be time, there almost certainly will be. And then we can do that again because we still have a class next Monday. All right, guys? Thanks. If you haven't got your paper, come back.
Thanks for listening to the lecture. All of the audio is available, of course, on iTunes or whatever podcatcher you're using. Just search for Dr. Dave Brodbeck's Psychology Lectures at Malcolm University, which is the most ungainly title ever. These are released under a Creative Commons copyright, ShareAlike 3.0 Canada. You can't use these for commercial purposes. You feel free to share them and feel free to mash them up any way you want, but if you do that, that means I get to do the same thing with your stuff. Sort of like the GNU license. I hope you learned something. But if you didn't, unless you're one of my students, I really don't care. The music, by the way, for each song, for each episode, lecture, is available. They're all podcast, like PodSafe music. So if you want to find out about the bands, there's links on my website at people.aoc.ca/Brodbeck. If those links don't work, just contact me and I'll find out. Often I put links actually in the if you want to call them show notes or blog posts. So you know, buy these people's music. They're making the stuff available out there. Thanks everybody, and we'll see you next time.